the subject I'm going to discuss is actually somewhat different from most of the talks you've heard yesterday, because it mostly deals with the questions of how do we actually quantitatively identify and understand the dynamics of the networks, rather than focusing on their properties. So at least the first part of the talk will be mostly focused on the networking properties of these systems and ways of finding out actually what they are at mechanistic level. As you can see, the background for my talk, both literally and figuratively, is the well-renowned Roche diagram of biomolecular pathways. This particular one happens to be in eukaryotic cells, but in general, it is, as you can see, rather colorful, but completely incomprehensible compilation of lines, circles, you know, crosses, and various other geometric forms, which is supposed to communicate to us somehow what the underlying properties and dynamics of the network are. Now, I could, of course, zoom in at each and every square. Roche provides this capability, and then start discussing what each and every step of the system does. But that actually would be going to the molecular scale of the system, and what I would like to emphasize in my talk is that we're really talking about two different scales here. Both in terms of regulation, but however, the properties they describe are quite different. First of all, on this kind of large and messy looking level, we got what we tend to call systems biology. I hope most of you know what systems biology is, because I really don't, but I have a feeling that it has something to do with how biological systems behave at a network scale, and in fact at a rather large network scale, somewhere on the order of an organism, be it a single cell or a multicellular organism. And throughout the talk, I might slip into calling this scale a macro scale, although of course in reality it deals with quite micro microbes or other fairly small, physically small systems. At the same time, of course, the different techniques that have been developed for representing this type of behavior are quite peculiar to it. This is an example from the well-known Kurt-Cohen's diagrams of mostly cell cycle and different checkpoint regulations. And you can see this is a good example of what a systems biology scale description would look like. It's a series of arrows. Some of them you can imagine being activators, some repressors, but generally it's sort of a circuit-like diagram that tells you what the regulation modes are at each stage without really getting into the underlying detail.
Can I just have one wrinkle to this? Evan Evans is, he's done some work on mechanics of bond set failure or dissociation, mm-hmm. and he finds that the force to detach a bond goes as a log of the loading rate. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the interactions in cells are loaded to mm-hmm. some extent. And so there's another dimension to this, and that's log of force applied to each one of those individual interactions.
Right.
Which will now determine rates, you know, not just the chemistry.
Of course, you're absolutely right. Cells are subject to various external forces, physical forces, or shear mechanical stresses. There are various thermodynamic forces, pressures exerted on the cell, temperature issues, and whatnot. However, the majority of cell structure is basically biochemistry, by a vast amount. And what we represent in terms of, for example, mechanical forces could equally be described in terms of chemical interactions. And I can tell you how exactly one would do it. But my point here is that at a macro scale, which in this case, again, is an organism scale, we could perhaps successfully, and for no other reason that there is no other choice, because we are really bound by the complexity of the system in terms of describing each and every individual interaction at its highest resolution. You know, potentially we could have gone to quantum mechanics, but then it would be just unsolvable. One can certainly write a Schrodinger equation for a cell, one can solve it in any meaningful way. So the lowest resolution that I've seen and can confidently consider being a lower level scale of the system is, of course, zooming in at one particular section of this network, one particular node perhaps, or a small clique of nodes. And zooming in, we discover that, in fact, of course, at a molecular level, there is, you know, indeed complexity of its own going on. There are molecular interactions of various sorts. This is an example of a well-known Fos-Jun motif in transcriptional regulation, specifically often used in cell cycle. You can see its representation in the Corcoran diagram is significantly more abstract than the specifics of the actual molecular dynamics. And while this scale we could be confidently called molecular modeling, the question becomes, well, A, how do we determine what the large-scale systems biology behavior of the system is and how is it structured? And B, when do we really need to zoom in to this lower level molecular scale, and what are the interesting things we can learn at that scale by trying to model and understand and describe the individual molecular interactions. So in this talk, I hope I can span those different regulation scales within a cell and perhaps tell you a story of how we're approaching it, what are some upsides and downsides to each one, and maybe give you some indication of where one is beneficial and can be used because of its sort of global representation and computability, and where a lower scale description is necessary. As such, different scales will require different tools, and with this I'll proceed to describe some of the quantitative tools at the network scales that we have been working on, their advantages, disadvantages, and some of the results of this work. One of the first sort of major determining factors of where to kind of cut the cake and decide what's relevant and what's not relevant is, first of all, to decide whether your description is going to be deterministic or is going to be a quote-unquote non-classical. By non-classical, I mean both the effects of stochasticity in the underlying system behavior, as well as discreteness. Those two terms, by the way, tend to be often mixed together and used either interchangeably or without real regard for what one brings to the equation versus the other. To me, they're quite different properties of the system, but by saying that we're considering a system in a deterministic limit, we're abrogating both, and usually one way or the other implying one of the classical chemical kinetics approaches to describing the system. Having said that, at networking scale, it's probably one of the only practical approaches for studying biological systems, again, due to the overwhelming complexity of those systems, because, you know, reasonably, we can currently model stochastically systems on maybe scales of 10 to the third molecules with the corresponding number of states being 10 to the third, while in a reasonably simple cell, the number of available states can run into 10 to the triple digits. So no practical approach right now is available for doing the non-classical description, thus we'll stick with the deterministic description, and it's a well-known and fairly robust way of dealing with those systems. For the analysis of gene regulation. We in particular are going to look at the thermodynamic kinetic representation. This is something that will be fairly familiar to chemically inclined here, but for those less familiar with this version of laws of mass action, I'm going to look at a specific example of what this representation looks like. It basically captures the possibility of multiple promoter states in this partition function. Probability of transcription term, and then has a decay term for mRNA. We're not going to go past simple decay here. So, for example, if your system or your promoter has three states, one being open promoter, nothing on it, one being a promoter blocked by some sort of repressor molecule, and the third one being that same promoter but with the binding site occupied by the RNA polymerase, then this Thatcher will look like this, where the partition function has all three promoter states. However, in the numerator, you only have the actively transcribing one, which is RNA polymerase-based term. However, in general, of course, for activator states and various other regulatory processes, these terms can depend on the concentrations of the transcription regulators of various sorts, be it repressors or activators. And since this is chemistry, all of these terms are polynomial in terms of the regulatory constants. That's or control constants. That actually turns out to be important because using this framework now, we can try to understand the underlying structure of the system at its biochemical level. Now, what's the selling point here? The selling point being that there have been a lot of methods recently developed and discussed that try to identify the underlying biochemical or cellular mechanisms from observations using methods such as statistical inference, for example. While those methods are useful in certain circumstances and can be used to identify certain parameters about the system, given the observations, they really impose no fundamental constraints on how the system is linked dynamically. That really blows up your state space, which is one of the reasons why probabilistic inference methods have been very computationally challenging, and also why there are some questions as to the relevance of the results if, for example, your conditions, your experimental conditions change, because the predictions you get from measurements given one set of environmental conditions may not necessarily lead to the same predictions or the same conditional distributions should your observation conditions or environmental conditions change, which is, of course, very important for any realistic biological organism.
So I have a question. What work are you referring to? What are you referring to when you talk about probabilistic inference methods?
I will not go pointing around to whose work is better or worse, but that's a general property of probabilistic inference methods.
But
where
what does that mean? What do you mean by that?
Probabilistic inference? That means where a technique where you start with some guess on the prior distribution of your parameters that you're presumably observing in the system. So that's a guess on Bayesian structure of your system. So you have a set of parameters that you're trying to infer. You make a guess on that set of parameters, and then you take your experimental data, you use the Bayes' rule to compute a conditional distribution, you plug it back in and you make an update. If you would like to get more details, we can discuss it afterwards, and I'd be happy to describe this in detail. The relevant point here is that instead of making no specific assumption about the underlying structure of molecular interactions within a system, we make a fairly strong assumption, in fact, impose this constraint that the behavior of the relevant gene in terms of its expression of our mRNA is guided by this type of a kinetic law in a deterministic sense. That's a standard chemical modeling technique that has, as we'll discuss later, a good substantiation in non-classical discrete stochastic description of molecular interactions, and at the same time has been proven phenomenologically by generations of chemists to really represent, in most cases, not all cases, but most cases, the underlying dynamics of the system. Now, I'm not saying anything new here. These techniques have been used in physical chemical settings for decades by now to determine the underlying structure of molecular reaction networks. In fact, you know, way back when, part of my PhD thesis dealt with using these same models, and the group I came from, and the one where Evan Martin spent a large fraction of his postdoc here, is the, namely John Ross's group at Stanford, has been working on questions of system identification and inference from time series, specifically observations, you know, probably since the 70s. So there is a large volume of literature that discusses the applicability of this type of models. The innovations that we add, first of all, deal with the usage of the thermodynamic weighting function for the rate of expression of the gene, and also, as you'll see in a second, with the actual way we figure out the underlying network structure from this description.
Sorry, another question. Your model can't deal with any type of regulated degradation of mRNA, is that right? Constant.
This one does not. There's nothing that prevents me from sticking in a term just like this one here and doing the same thing. As you'll see next, it will actually be subsumed in the following step, but for the sake of this talk, let's just assume that the degradation is either unregulated or the protease is present in roughly constant concentration, so you can fold it into the degradation. Thus, using this framework, we come up with the method that we call enrich algorithm that uses basically data fusion techniques. And enrich stands for enhanced network reconstruction by identification of connectivity from heterogeneous data, heterogeneous being the idea of data fusions, to convert the various types of observations that you can make about the system into a biochemically constrained prediction of its structure. Now, the sources of this data could be rather varied. We could use, and will use in this example, microarrays, measurements for the expression ratios of the underlying genes. We can also take that very result of probabilistic inference in terms of how the connectivity network and control in the network looks like, plug it in as well, and make a prediction as to what is the closest biochemically consistent network structure would look like. So you give me my prey data, or you can give me connectivity data in the form of, let's say, probabilistic inference predictions. I will give you a biochemically consistent representation of the network, or that same data could be, for example, results of chip-chip direct binding experiments, as a result on your organism, which is in fact what we'll use in this example. To give you some ideas to what the algorithm does, it basically uses that dynamic law in a stationary state limit, meaning that your observations have to be on the scale or less frequent than your slowest dynamic in that network, typically driven by RNA decay rates.
So can you explain that again? You're saying...
So we will...
You're looking at variables that have slow dynamics?
I'm looking at measurements that are taken relatively slowly compared to the dynamics in the system that actually drive this derivative. So I'm going to take a stationary state here. And as an example, so this form, in fact, is, for those of you familiar, somewhat similar to the rather successful approach by James Lau and co-workers in offering the NCA, which stands for Network Component Analysis Algorithm. So, except these things mean somewhat different things, and more importantly, what we compute is different, but in terms of the constraints we impose on the system, they are quite similar to the NCA range of biochemical modeling. As an example of the meaning of these quantities, for example, for a simple repressor, this delta D entry would be a minus one. For a simple activator, this would be a plus one. And of course, various cooperativity effects will potentially change these numbers to something different.
Could,
so,
could you just explain what the symbols in that equation are?
Okay, so this is recognizable as the mRNA log ratio, which is what you measure in microarray experiments.
With MT and MTB?
Okay, this is the measurement point. It could be either in time, so you're taking a time-spaced series, or it could be in other variables, such as pH, for example.
So that's not multiplying mRNA, that's mRNA is a
function. No, this is a function at that point. So mRNA level
compared
at that point.
Control.
Right, compared to baseline.
This is basically a free energy balance.
Chemical
balance. Yeah.
What's TRR? TRR is the activity, if you want to be specific, of a transcription regulator that either activates or represses the particular.
That's
gene.
A concentration of transcription
regulator? Typically, it would be a concentration. So, you know, in general, of course, activity is, you know, potentially concentration to some power, or if you want to, as we'll see in a second, go into discrete stochastic representation of the system, the accurate quantity here would be the number of molecules.
Yeah, just as an aside, because that measured number is in the really low, you know, unit digits, it's not like a very high concentration. If you do a concentration, you're going to be dealing with very fractional concentrations.
This is fine, again, as long as your deterministic limit works. It doesn't really matter what the absolute quantity of this parameter is. If the deterministic description breaks down, then we have to do something else, which I will actually discuss in the second part of my talk.
So, sorry.
How much time? Like,
expression changes, that's because the transcriptional regular concentration changed or
right.
the RNA polymerase changed.
Right.
Does that make sense?
And there are higher order terms here which we can iteratively solve for.
And what are the delta G? Delta, G,
delta G, G. So the key here is that, again, these delta G's are coefficients that could be related to the. To the orders of this reaction here, that they're not exactly those. And so basically they quantify the regulatory or control level of particular transcription factor over mRNA. So that's their meaning. Their exact formula is somewhat complicated, but they are function of the order of regulation of each particular transcription transcription regulatory molecule. And as an example, it turns out that for a simple repressor, it's just minus one. So
everything on the right-hand side is unknown. That's what you're trying to fit. That's
right.
And on the left, you have some microarray
information. Exactly. And we might have a guess on what this looks like. We might not. But for the moment, let's assume we'll have a guess or an incomplete set of measurements. The key here, again, is that this representation is, in some sense, universal with respect to the external conditions because it represents the underlying biochemistry. So even if my experimental conditions change, the environment of an organism or a cell changes, these things would change, these things would change, these things would not change. I'll give you a concrete example in the next slide about this. As many as you can offer, but in order to sort of make it more concrete, we took your garden variety Spelman data set. So as well studied of a system as there is out there for yeast, and as a guess on what the regulatory structure of that system is. So Spelman said there are four or five different data sets measured by Spelman co-workers, and I think Boston Lab in 1998 was one of the first large-scale microarray experiments measuring time series over the cell cycle. They measured a few hundred genes. Of those, we took 69, 23 regulatory interactions from a different source. That's Lee and co-workers, chip data on direct binding. We only took the PCR-confirmed interactions to make sure that these those are there, and also, as you can see, the relative number.
The delta Ds.
Right.
Use that to determine
right,
the delta
right, exactly. So basically, this data is present as log ratios. This data is present in qualitative form as Cas9 interacts with PTR2 gene. We feed both into the algorithm, starting with ones or minus ones, basically. If it interacts, the initial guess is that it's either a simple activator or a simple repressor. Now we get information on connectivity, regulated time series, and control in this network. In terms of connectivity, this could be easily visualized as the initial connectivity matrix being that Lee set is black squares for no information or zeros. White squares is whether they report chip-chip interactions. That is one or minus one, very qualitative. Out we get the enriched view, which in it has 383 new connections in top of 79 original that we recover. And all of this takes less than 1 minute. which, as I mentioned, a big improvement over many alternative approaches such as probabilistic inference-based ones. Now, of course, it's great to have all these connections, all these regulatory predictions. You know, some of them are repressive, some of them are activator. What is, you know, how meaningful are these predictions?
Are you going to talk about how you do that? How you get that picture?
No, I just gave you a general overview of what the algorithm looks like. I won't go into the details. I will go into the results and the interpretation.
But you have to do a complicated parameter estimation for all these unknowns,
right,
in your model.
Right. And the idea is that we will do, we did a constraint fit to that formula that I've shown you in the previous slide.
Question?
Right. So under certain constraints, we solve this equation for these two unknowns. And we can iteratively solve it for other unknowns. We assume here that mRNA levels don't change. For simplicity.
Just summation over R, so you have many unknowns, right?
Right. So in fact, it's a matrix, 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 matrix.
So isn't it pretty seriously underdetermined?
It is, but it turns out that we can impose meaningful constraints to resolve this uniquely. I will not go into the math of it.
What type of constraint? I mean, that plays a very large role in determining your prediction.
Right. Well, it turns out not so if you assume that you have an initial guess, and then if you assume that you need to do a bilinear decomposition. In fact, it turns out that bilinear decomposition space is rather constrained. So if you know the dimensions of this, you know the dimensions of this, and you know that this has to be close to your initial guess, turns out to be sufficient.
What's a bilinear decomposition?
When you take a matrix m by n, you have to decompose it into the product of two matrices, n by l and l by m.
So you have to say that you know the number of regulatory interactions ahead of time.
Right. You have to have a guess on that number.
Okay, so...
Well, you can take maximum number if you want. Just many of them will end up being meaningless because they won't regulate anything. In this case, we had a predetermined set. So I'll try to move quicker because I have the non-deterministic part coming for those who are interested.
One more question for you.
Just for you. Okay.
There were 79 chip-chip connections.
There were 79, yes.
And then you retained the 79.
Plus 318 new ones.
But I think, maybe I'm mistaken, but I thought that the part of the problem with chip-chip was that you got tons of false positives.
Right. So this is the ultra verified set with by explicit PCR amplification. They actually went in and right. So I'm not taking all of their data. There'll be, you know, just as many by the first pass chip. I'm just taking the ultra high confidence ones and then run the algorithm on those. So, how meaningful are these predictions? Well, in order to do this, we hand curated five of the regulators from literature. It turns out that for those five regulators, of the 122 further interactions, 66 could be confirmed through other sources, which implies a 23% false positive rate or less for the whole set. This compares very favorably with a typical false positive rate for any number of methods for inferring a regulatory structure of a gene regulatory network. And Wimberly and co-workers did this analysis. For all of those, they get over 50%. We get less than 23. So it's, you know, at least a factor of two improvement in percentage terms. Now, the other thing that we get out of this, other than regulatory structure of the network, which is universal, as I said, that's a great benefit, are the regulator time series themselves. And that turns out to be an interesting source of further understanding of the system function and structure. So what's given here sine courses of the regulators, which are proteins, plotted versus the time courses of the mRNAs of their respective genes. Now, the interesting thing here that I'd like to emphasize is that the system didn't know anything about the behavior of those specific proteins or their underlying genes. So we did not use these time series or any other information about these genes was not used by the algorithm for reconstructing and predicting the behavior of the protein. So both of them are completely unsupervised. These are gray are measurements, green are regulator effector molecule time series. Now, just eyeballing it, you know, some of them seem to match pretty well, and you can imagine that, you know, first the gene goes up, then with some time delay, the product shows up. So these seem to be, you know, quite well represented with these guys that are fairly noisy, and this is again cell cycle data. You know, seems like it has overall the same behavior, can tell. Here seems like it's, you know, all over the place. Here it seems to do well. Further analysis hence is needed, which will tell us something important about these particular genes and their corresponding products.
Model assumes steady state. So how do you get time series?
Right. So you're measuring at, in this case, every 30 minutes. You assume that the evolution of mRNA is in the quasi-steady state, which is, you know, equivalent to the adiabatic condition, that the derivative is simply much smaller than the corresponding terms in the differential equation. And there are good reasons for doing it again. Satisfying, for example, quasi-QSSA condition would be one of those.
Right, so why does it change in time at all if it's a steady state?
It's an adiabatic steady state. It's the same idea, if you're familiar with Michaelis-Menten dynamics, as this, where, of course the concentrations change, but in the differential equation that you saw, the derivative term is much smaller than other constitutive terms.
Every experiment is fit independently, because he's showing a fit parameter at every experiment.
Right. Exactly. So what we can get out of this is the information about the corresponding control of these genes. And to do this, we'll look at time-like correlations. That's a fairly well-known technique where you basically shift the two series against each other, find the maximum correlation. And what we'd expect is the following, that if the correlation is positive and the if the time shift is negative, correlation is positive, that's your normal garden variety gene, which means that, you know, first the gene goes up or down, changes, then the regulator does something similar. So gene, regulator. Now, that's not the only possibility. If the correlation is positive, the time delay is positive, what that means is that the behavior of the regulator and the gene, their time series, are reversed, meaning that gene does whatever the product does and not the other way around. And if you think about it a little bit, the only way it can do this is if there's a positive feedback loop between the gene and its product. So that's a positive self-regulator that we would identify if we see a pattern like this. Then, analogously, if we, however, see a negative correlation, so they're anti-correlated, but a positive time delay, well, that would mean that gene does the opposite of whatever the product does. So the product goes down, gene goes up, product goes up, gene goes down. That is a characteristic behavior for negative feedback, meaning that whatever the product does, it inhibits its own gene. And finally, if you see something else, then, well, you just got crazy, or the system did the same. Fortunately, we see none of those because this would mean that the gene goes up and then the product goes down. While you can conceive of mechanisms that would do this, that would be, you know, a highly unusual and funky mechanism that you can construct in abstract theory, but not really expect to see in nature, and in fact we do not see any of those. So the key classes are normal positive feedback genes and negative feedback genes. And what we see of those here is that there is indeed a pattern emerging. So these are the corresponding plots of time-like correlations. And first of all, in these three cases, we have genes that are either responsible or parts of cell cycle, SWI4 and FHL, which is forehead-like protein, or we have a stress response protein. In all of those cases, as Hans Meinhardt told us yesterday, we want this memory effect, where, you know, the system, once set off, wants to maintain that behavior and, in fact, ramp up as fast as possible, you know, because, you know, something's attacking it that needs to has to die, or because it committed to a cell cycle and it needs to progress in a definitive manner because it made the commitment past all the checkpoints it needed, and thus there is no reason to think about it anymore. Alternatively, if we have something that is a global cell state regulator, which affects multiple functions, and in this case, such critical functions like ribosomal gene regulation, so on and so forth, it's important that this gene product is maintained at a very tight level. And in fact, RAP1 is just such a protein. Overexpression of RAP1 is lethal, knockouts are lethal, so it's incredibly important for the cell to maintain it in a very tight dynamic range. In this case, we would expect a negative feedback that clamps down on any potential fluctuations up. In fact, that's, again, what we see here. So, to summarize, using these deterministic thermodynamic kinetic representations of the system, we can faithfully and biochemically meaningfully model the underlying molecular network behavior and get fundamental information about its dynamics, its regulatory structure, and its control in a universal way with respect to external conditions. Go ahead.
Just real quick before we leave this methodology and move on to the next one, if you go back a slide, have you begun to try to pull out some higher order regulatory elements, some of the feed forward circuits or AND behavior?
Certainly could be done.
Because you can go beyond the just positive and negative feedback. I guess, like, Yuri Alon identified something like 6 motifs that are
prevalent
in terms of regulatory networks.
They did, again, they did it by other techniques.
I'm just wondering if you pulled that same regulatory architecture out of your techniques, or whether they'd be different.
It certainly would be very interesting. I agree with you. When I'm overfitting my data, what exactly do you mean? I mean, we're assuming deterministic models, so all I'm saying is that under the maximum likelihood or least variance criterion or whatever you want to use, this is the most likely structure of the network.
Have you tried to use that network structure to predict the results of other microarray experiments that weren't used in the training?
Well, no, it's the other way around. You use microarrays to understand and predict the behavior of the underlying transcription factors, which is what we did, and they seem to do quite well. So we can go back. No, I understand what you're saying. We can go back, take that control structure and try to predict the behavior of microarrays. The challenge there would be that, you know, you need something else. You would need then to have the regulator time series or simulated regulator time series of some other time series to generate the microarrays. And that is harder to do because it's harder to measure regulated time series in a quantifiable sense, but it certainly could be done. So, now, one word with this one. The network part, as I hope to either convince you or at least to consider the fact that it could be reasonably well described by these deterministic representations. However, it has been speculated, and now it has been experimentally validated, that in many circumstances, the underlying discrete and stochastic nature of molecular processes does rear its either ugly or beautiful, depending on your perspective, head upon the behavior of the underlying gene regulatory systems, the seminal work by Elowitz in designing a system to actually quantitatively measure that noise, and the more recent work by Golding in estimating or measuring the number of RNA transcript distribution, show that, in fact, biological systems are highly non-deterministic, at least in certain regimes, for certain molecular mechanisms. Now, those are quite complicated molecular mechanisms. You can, in fact, rather easily show that a similar, even more dramatic effects can show up in extremely simple systems. One of those systems happens to be the enzymatic cell cycle, which I won't spend much time on. We've demonstrated that if this cycle is classically analyzed, and this goes back to the very influential work by Koshland on zero-order alder sensitivity, how you generate cooperativity in chemical systems without having multiple multimers, that in fact this system behaves monostably if you look at it deterministically. However, if you look at it stochastically, either via Langevin or via chemical master equation, you in fact might end up getting stochastic switching or oscillations. So in fact, you can turn this very simple thing to oscillator without doing anything to it by just having a noisy level of the enzyme. Doesn't have to be bistable. This is in the paper. I've asked Stacy to put a few copies outside in case you're interested. There is also some other interesting works on a similar subject. I saw a poster from Kian's group, which I think has a similar mechanism in testosterone production, I believe. So if you're interested in this type of system, please check out that poster. I will, in fact, look at something different here and try to consider generally what does it take to quantitatively analyze these types of discrete stochastic behaviors in molecular systems. How much time?
11 minutes.
Okay, that will be really quick. So probabilistic non-classical description of chemical kinetics is most generally considered in terms of chemical master equation. Just to give a very brief overview of what this entails, for those not a little familiar with this, let's say we have two species in our dynamic system. It basically means that in reality, we're living on a lattice of discrete molecular states. If we, and then we have a time coordinate that moves along as individual reactions fire. So we have this double dynamics, the discrete dynamics of moving on the lattice and the stochastic dynamics of individual molecular collisions that could potentially result in reactions. If we start a system in a deterministic state, meaning starts at time zero somewhere on this lattice, say this point has, four molecules of X2 and, four molecules of X1 in this case, then what we do is that we have a formula for the rates at which these molecular collisions might happen, and they typically depend on the number of molecules for bimolecular reaction. On the product of those two numbers, we fire this rate reaction. It tells us when the reaction has happened and which reaction moves us along the lattice, both in time. It tells us how much time it took for the collision to happen. Use Monte Carlo for this, and where it moved on the lattice from the original point. Again, from that point, we fire another reaction, so completely Markov process, no memory here. We move somewhere else, could be a different reaction, thus we could move by a different amount of molecules on this lattice, and then we just keep on firing and keep on firing and keep on firing, and the system just traces out a certain path on this lattice and gives us a certain progression in time. That's where we end up with the trajectory of a system in space and a sequence of time points on the t-axis instead of a continuous sort of function. And the mathematical description of this is the master equation, which basically what it does is says, okay, if I have a certain probability of being in state some other than x at time t, and then I get instantaneous transition rates given by these w's of going into state x, then that's a flux into this probability weight for this particular state, and out goes the flux of actually being in that state and moving out of it at time t. The difference could be represented by this sum over all possible reactions that either get us in to the state x at time t by firing this particular transition probability, which corresponds to the certain collision type, or moving out of that state. And so this flux in, flux out gives us a balance equation, which is the master equation. The challenge, of course, is the problem that this is a differential difference equation. We have a continuous derivative this side. We have a discrete difference equation on the right side. Solutions to those equations are typically nightmarish and very hard to get. You saw a reasonably simple and manageable case of a discrete, not differential, but just discrete equation by, I believe, James McGrath yesterday in application to axon cycling. Well, there the system was very simple. It was linear in x in all cases, for which there is a general solution which James used to solve his system. However, for nonlinear systems such as chemical, where you have bimolecular reactions and you have terms here of order x squared, there is no such general solution. And thus you're either left with a really hard equation or some numerical methods for solving it. However, it has its advantages. It captures the discrete nature of molecular states and also represents the stochastic nature of individual reactions and ties them together. So, to make it more concrete as to where you would actually be concerned with those things, I'm not going to get into deeply into questions where you would be concerned in general, but just to give you a tangible example. You know, we saw this post-June system at a molecular level. However, in fact, let's consider something more realistic. Let's look at a tyrosine kinase second message signaling network. This type of a system where you have a phosphorylated monomers recruits the unphosphorylated one. That is phosphorylated. The association leaves you with a population of phosphorylated monomers. Those could then form a dimer, and the dimer then potentially is transported to the nucleus and used as a transcription factor. Then after a while it gets either diphosphorylated or other diphosphorylated, dissociates and spits back monomers, is a fairly frequently encountered motif. For example, models of JAK-STAT pathway in lymphocytes mapped on, onto the system. Alternatively, in fact, any chemical or biochemical system that follows this general representation has a autocatalytic, or effectively autocatalytic term here, and a bimolecular term here, could exhibit the characteristic dynamic in the system that is overtly non-deterministic. And in fact, the word deterministic description will fail, and you'll need a master equation description to correctly understand what's going on with the system. To make things even simpler, let's look at just this set of coupled chemical reactions. You can think of them as having rapid equilibrium here, rapid equilibrium here, meaning that binding and unbinding rates in this reaction and this reaction are much faster than the actual dissociation rates on the complex, which in the case of let's say, a transcription factor would be reasonable because it gets pumped into the nucleus, spends a while there activating targets it needs to activate, and then after a while it gets dissociated and released. That's a fairly slow process, while the signaling mechanism is quite fast. So reducing it to this simplified form, which I do only so I can actually show you the math being manageable, we can look at the system in a deterministic fashion. That's fairly simple. You get two mass action differential equations. You can get rid of one of the variables by taking into account the mass conservation conditions. And out of this, with basic undergraduate chemistry, come two steady states, zero solution of this guy, one at zero, one at some other level which is separated from zero on the system scale level, so this could be way higher. The key is that in the deterministic description, we've seen some of those issues in earlier talks, one of those stationary states will end up being unstable, and you can easily show with linear perturbation of these equations that the in deterministic sense, this guy, the low state is unstable, basically put delta here, it goes away, and you'll see a pump. And the high state is the stable one. So you would imagine that classically you would expect your system to sit in this state and have a permanently active signaling cycle with phosphorylated monomers being cycled through the signaling pathways, released as unphosphorylated ones, and coming back on and on, and that's the signaling pathway continues to be active. X is the phosphorylated one.
X is phosphorylated.
And so going back to...
And when they bind together...
Right. So X,
okay.
Y.
Okay, so then...
Very fast, relatively slow. So that if the net reaction for this case are dimerization... two X's going to through some stationary concentration dimer to two unphosphorylated guys, and the phosphorylated guy cooperatively causing the unphosphorylated one to phosphorylate. The net effect is that deterministically you would predict about the system that would approach a stationary state at some non-zero level of X, meaning that you always have phosphorylated dimers in your system, thus your signaling pathway continues to be active through the second messenger. You just keep on firing. However, non-classically, things are different, which you could suspect by simply kind of staring at the system and noticing that since X is produced from Y autocatalytically, then if by some chance you somehow lose all the X's, you can't really make them anymore. And since things are bouncing around stochastically, you would imagine that eventually this would happen. you would somehow lose all of the access to this reaction, none will be left, and thus you will end up in a state of no X, which would mean that, in fact, the zero state is the absolutely stable state. And, in fact, you can write down the master equation for the system, and in this case, for the stationary solution, you can iteratively solve it, and out comes your non-deterministic solution validated that, in fact, the stationary, the stationary solution is stable at x equals zero. Sorry, go ahead.
Can I ask a naive question? Is that master equation equivalent to putting gravity in motion in the ODEs or diffusion?
No, that's actually a very good point, and if I get a couple more minutes, I will briefly touch upon this, but that's one of the points here that, in fact, it is tempting to describe the system stochastically in the sort of simple stochastic sense by looking at Langevin representation, taking the deterministic equations, sticking some sort of a noise term here, and thinking that this is going to give you the stochastic behavior of the system. Turns out not to be the case, because it's not just the stochastic behavior of molecular interaction that's important, but also the discreteness of individual molecules. And you lose this with this Langevin approach, which is very popular, but often, as is in this case, unproductive and wrong, in fact. So that the correct answer is that the system is...
Isn't there a review article by Denise and Chris saying that you can and should do that sometimes?
Sorry?
I mean, there's a review article by Denise and Chris saying that you can and should do that sometimes.
Sometimes you can and should. And in fact, if you look at that paper that I suggested for the enzymatic feedback cycle, first part of the analysis is by Langevin. So in fact, in some cases, Langevin will do a great job, as Chris and Denise have shown. However, in other cases, it won't, and the key is to understand when. So
large numbers of molecules are
VRL. Typically, in fact, it's not so much the absolute number of molecules; it's that the system has to be insensitive to single molecule scale. I can show you afterwards a simple system that has, you know, as large of a number of molecules as you like, and yet Langevin will be unable to correctly describe its stochastic behavior because it turns out to be sensitive to parity in the absolute number of molecules. So if you're sensitive to whether the number of molecules, let's say, is odd or even, you're typically going to lose it with Langevin as well, even though the total number could be, you know, arbitrarily big.
But some of these can be, I mean, if you wanted to use Langevin and you wanted to get the right answer, at least in simulation, you can kind of kludge it by having an extinction threshold.
Well, you have to know where the extinction threshold is. So there is no general Langevin method that tells you how to make kludges. So the question is not that, you know, some... you know, a hypothetical Langevin equation might not be able to describe it. It's just there are, you know, three or four different ways of writing consistently a Langevin equation in chemistry, and none of those will consistently pick up this.
This is not a stochastic effect. This is a continuum approximation.
Well, it is the interaction between stochastics and discreteness.
That attractor state is zero. It has nothing to do with noise.
It is the interaction between the discreteness and stochasticity in the system. Like I said in the beginning, there are two aspects to non-classical behavior of chemical systems, the discrete and the stochastic. And it's important to capture and correctly describe both. And sometimes describing one correctly and forgetting the other will give you the wrong understanding of how the system behaves, either because the one is important or because they somehow interact.
Well,
so,
that equation you can think of as completely deterministic.
Yeah, you should capture this with a discrete deterministic system.
In this case, yes. Except that you would need to have something driving you towards the zero state. Because if, for example, if you start at the zero state and you're doing discrete deterministic, then it would be okay. However, if you're doing discrete deterministic but you're starting at the state above the stationary state, above the deterministic stationary state, which is somewhere over. So let me move on to the next slide. Maybe that will make it simpler. No, that won't make it simpler. I'll skip this one. So that other slide actually quantifies analytically what goes on, where the breakdowns occur and when you can and cannot use the deterministic approximation, Langevin approximation, so on and so forth. Just to address the point of what actually goes on here is that you know, if you start above the classical stationary state, which sits over here, then if you just think of the system as being deterministic in the mass action sense, you'll follow this black trajectory and you'll get stuck in the upper state and you won't get the right answer. If you think of the system as stochastic in a continuous sense with Langevin term, so you'll have a continuous equation with you know, white noise term stuck on it, you still won't get the correct answer, because what will happen is that you will come here bouncing, you'll bounce like this. You will sometimes hit zero, but because you are continuous, you'll just bounce back and come back. And you'll still mostly sit around the stationary, the classical stationary state. If you think of yourself as discrete but deterministic, as you just proposed, what will happen if you're starting above, you'll go discretely, you will end up at around the classical stationary state. Had you been able to move down and get to the zero state, you would correctly end up staying there, but unfortunately, because you're deterministic, you will never get there, because you'll deterministically just sit here because there's no noise to drive you down. So in fact, in this case, you will need all aspects of the discrete and stochastic representation provided by a chemical mass equation. You cannot use Langevin by itself, you cannot use discrete but deterministic by itself, you need discrete stochastic, which is what Langevin, which is what chemical mass equation that I described before offers, and which Langevin or mass action kinetics misses one way or the other. And this is the mechanism of what's going on. You just bounce around. Finally, you hit the kitchen sink and really sink into this sink state where you, from which you can no longer move. The problem with the deterministic description is that it actually, there is a misconception out there. The misconception is that mass action kinetics describes the averages of number of molecules in the system. That is actually incorrect. What it describes is it describes the mode of the distribution of the molecular state. And this is a good example of where the difference occurs. So mode is actually the peak of the distribution. And the average is, you know, the average, the weighted sum over states. So while in this case the deterministic mass action solution follows the mode as it's supposed to, in this previous slide with the previous slides with the ugly formulas actually was designed to show you how you can actually convince yourself that deterministic mass action kinetics follows the mode of the distribution and not its average, which is considerably different. You know, if I
so it's a mode of the transition probability.
It's the mode of the state probability of the solution. So if I can actually draw on this thing. What you would get is you get distribution like this. This would be the mode. And here would be the average. So average somewhere here, mode here. So mode is the peak, average is some sort of a weighted sum. And the deterministic distribution and the mass action kinetics follows the behavior of this peak, not of the average. And that's where the problem comes from, because here the mass action kinetics trajectory gets stuck with the sort of false mode of the top peak, while the system stochastically bounces and pumps more and more weight into the zero state, which is correctly described by the average, but not picked up by the deterministic description or by the mode, because, again, the mode simply gets stuck in this transitory peak, which is where the mass action kinetics gets stuck, while the overall system behavior switches towards the zero state and invalidates the deterministic classical behavior, and with that, okay, so this was the example of where the Langevin description fails. If you just simply stick a noise term onto the classical description, which is tempting to do, you will still end up with a wrong solution instead of here. And on that, I will, okay, so stochastic dynamics in this system in particular will, what is the tangible result that, as you know, a biologist, you would expect to see in the system from stochastic and discrete stochastic analysis rather than your classical analysis? Well, what you would see is that instead of sitting in a sort of cycle of activated signaling without any shutdowns, because there are no negative feedbacks here to shut you off, in fact, this system will shut down due to the stochastic effect, because the absolutely stable state is not at the high mass action kinetic level, but at the zero discrete stochastic level, and it's zero of these guys. So without any negative feedback, this signaling pathway will shut down, because it will stochastically run out of these guys, and deterministically it will not do that. And the second thing is that in culture, if you actually look at cell culture, what you'll see is you'll see a bimodality in the distribution of cells, because cells will individually shut down, shut down, shut down, shut down due to the stochasticity. And what you'll see is you'll see bimodal cell population, one at zero, no signal, one at the deterministic high level of signaling, rather than just a monomodal distribution around the deterministic peak. So again, biologically, you'll see bimodal cell distribution rather than monomodal. That's another qualitative result. And in summary, what we've discussed is that in biological systems, a biochemical-based description has some significant advantages in understanding the network scale behavior of the system. It gives you high fidelity results, it's computation efficient, it will provide you with regulatory information, and more importantly, it is universally applicable regardless of how the external conditions of the organism change and the conditions under which the measurements were taken. So I can make very specific experimental conditions and their results apply to the general behavior of the system. And at the individual molecular modeling scale, you might often have to consider the discrete stochastic behavior of the system. It can lead to characteristically different and unintuitive behavior of the mechanism. And finally, because the local effects can propagate through signaling pathways, it can actually lead the whole system to behave rather non-classically, even though just one molecular mechanism is doing something unintuitive. For example, lead to bimodal populations in cell culture rather than monomodal. Thank you very much.